Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is Sod 2 of For the Record program number 579, titled Give Me a Break, Reflections on the Death of Gerald Ford. This has been recorded on January 7th of the year 2007. Well, once again, Happy New Year to the For the Record listeners. We're going to jump right in where and resume the thread of the discussion where we left off on side two. Now, Gerald Ford, of course, is primarily remembered for his role in, quote, stabilizing, unquote, the U.S. after the Watergate scandal. He also was the man who pardoned Richard Nixon of all crimes that he might have committed, not just all crimes connected to Watergate, but all crimes committed. Richard Nixon's downfall basically pivoted on his failure to release Watergate tapes, his stonewalling on releasing Watergate tapes. What he was afraid of was that if the tapes that were produced by his secret White House taping system were released, then, quote, the whole Bay of Pigs thing, unquote, might come out. As we saw in Side 1, the whole Bay of Pigs thing was a code word in the Nixon White House for the Kennedy assassination, and as we saw in Side 1, Nixon was in Dallas on November 22, 1963, flew out about the time Kennedy was being killed, maybe an hour or two before, and yet when the FBI interviewed him, he said the only time he was in Dallas was 2 days prior to the assassination of Kennedy. That lie, and a lie it most assuredly was, would be grounds for convicting him of perjury, since he said it to law enforcement officers, and indicting him for the assassination of President Kennedy. Now, also, in Side 1, we took a look at information from Bernard Fensterwald's book, Coincidence or Conspiracy, alleging that White House counsel Charles Colson had consulted with a man named Gordon Novell, who was one of the focal points of Garrison's investigation into the Kennedy assassination. Novell was a formidable veteran intelligence operative whose specialty is electronic counterintelligence. Colson was consulting with Novell, according to Fensterwald, to study the feasibility of erasing the Watergate tapes using a high-tech degaussing gun. In a technology publication, Gordon Novell made an enigmatic reference to his ultra-high technology role to erase the Watergate tapes, as he put it. And in 1984, specifically in the early morning hours of October 29th of 1984, that was very early on a Monday morning, I was a guest on a talk show on a then album-oriented rock station called KOME in the Bay Area. And Gordon, I'd been discussing the Kennedy assassination. Gordon Novell overheard my remarks and phoned in, took issue with my discussion of his role in the Garrison investigation. And then in response to a question that I had, he made a very interesting comment. This is from For the Record program number 253, in turn, the segment of the interview with Gordon Novell was from, again, a talk show that was recorded on October 29th of 1984. In addition to my own voice, you'll also hear the voice of Gordon Novell.
I have to move along here, Mr. Novell. There is just one quick, so in other words, you deny actually having erased the Watergate tapes.
Only because they didn't pay me.
That, again, from For the Record program 253, in turn an excerpt from an interview, an appearance that I made on an album-oriented rock station in the Bay Area, then called KOME, that was on October 29th of 1984. Now, in other comments made in that interview, Gordon Novell maintained that what Colson was actually consulting with him about concerned the origins of the law that was used to indict the Watergate burglars. That does not explain his enigmatic comment that the only reason he was denying erasing the Watergate tapes was, quote, because they didn't pay me, unquote, nor his enigmatic reference in the letter to Technology Review. However, I'm sure that's about as far as any of this is going to go. And again, Gordon Novell is an individual who is as formidable as he is enigmatic, not someone with whom you want to mess. It does, however, may raise some interesting questions about those Watergate tapes and just what might have been on them and just what the whole Bay of Pigs thing might have revealed. In the years since Kennedy was killed, of course, researchers have come up with an awful lot about what was actually going on. Now, again, Gerald Ford was not only a member of the Warren Commission, he also was J. Edgar Hoover's FBI informant on the Warren Commission. We're going to turn now to an excerpt from the book J. Edgar Hoover, The Man and His Secrets, authored by Kurt Gentry, and of Gerald Ford's role as an informant for the FBI on the Warren Commission, Gentry writes, and by the way, he refers to the Warren Commission as the committee. The committee learned next to nothing about Jack Ruby, little more about certain of Lee Harvey Oswald's associations, and nothing at all about the growing escalation of mob threats against the president and attorney general as picked up by FBI bugs, taps, and informants. They were never informed of the Hosty note or the Trafficante threat or Marcello's Livarsina Petra di La Scarpa or of any other assassination talk the FBI may have overheard and suppressed. Nor were they told that Hoover's informant on the commission was Representative Gerald Ford. Now, recall in Side 1, we took a look at some speculative information presented by the late Penn Jones. Jones has speculated that Nixon was actually in Dallas, Texas to, among other things, attend a final planning session for Kennedy's assassination at the home of independent oil man Clint Murchison. Penn Jones also alleges that among the people in attendance at that meeting was J. Edgar Hoover. If, in fact, there's any substance to Penn Jones' speculation, it makes Gerald Ford's role as Hoover's informant on the Warren Commission even more important because, according to Penn Jones, if his information is correct, that would have made Hoover one of the original conspirators. Whatever the accuracy of Penn Jones' speculation, what is more than a little interesting was that not only was Gerald Ford a member of the Warren Commission, but another key figure in Watergate, namely Watergate Special Prosecutor Leon Jaworski, had been a key Warren Commission counsel. Now, when Richard Nixon was trying to bury the Watergate scandal once and for all, he fired Watergate Special Prosecutor Archibald Cox, who, by the way, had also been President Kennedy's Solicitor General. Eventually, Archibald Cox was replaced by Leon Jaworski as Watergate Special Prosecutor. Leon Jaworski had been a very important Warren Commission counsel. He also was one of two men to head up the Texas Court of Inquiry. That was the state of Texas's body put together to investigate the Kennedy assassination. Perhaps even more significantly, Leon Jaworski was on the board of directors of the M.D. Anderson Fund, a CIA domestic funding conduit. Jaworski also had been one of the key people involved with the Nuremberg tribunals as well, assessing the guilt or innocence of various figures from the Third Reich. What we're going to do for the balance of this broadcast is to read some excerpts. I've done this on other shows, to read some excerpts from Jack Ruby's interview with the Warren Commission on June 7th, 1964. Now, of course, Jack Ruby was a veteran mobster. He was the fellow who killed Lee Harvey Oswald, thus preventing Oswald from giving any testimony about his alleged guilt. Again, Jack Ruby was a key mobster. Interestingly enough, another fellow who passed away about the same time as Gerald Ford was Lamar Hunt of the very powerful right-wing Texas Hunt family. The day before President Kennedy was killed, Texas mobster Jack Ruby attended a meeting, visited Lamar Hunt's offices in Dallas, Texas. The precise subject of discussion has never been disclosed. But when Jack Ruby was interviewed by the Warren Commission on June 7, 1964, he made it very clear to the Warren Commission that he wanted to speak with Earl Warren and others without the presence of his attorney, Joe Tannehill, whom he mistrusted, and other Dallas law enforcement and judicial officials. Many people believe that Jack Ruby was subjected to some form of mind control and he could not say Oswald's name directly. That plus Ruby's own labored syntax makes some of what Ruby had to say kind of difficult to understand, but it's quite clear in listening to Ruby's Warren Commission testimony that he was part of a conspiracy to murder Kennedy. His part, obviously, was to silence Oswald, that Ruby was aware of this, and that he wanted to basically spill the beans to the Warren Commission. And it's also quite obvious that the Warren Commission, in particular Earl Warren, was not interested in hearing what Ruby had to say. Now, in addition to Earl Warren and Ruby's attorney, Joe Tannehill, and some other people, present at this meeting were Gerald Ford, the aforementioned Leon Jaworski, and also another Warren Commission counsel named Arlen Specter, who is today a Republican senator from Pennsylvania and was until recently chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee. So we're going to see what Jack Ruby had to say to, among others, Earl Warren, eventual Watergate special prosecutor, then Warren Commission counsel Leon Jaworski, and also Arlen Specter. So Gerald Ford, Leon Jaworski, Arlen Specter, and Earl Warren heard what you're about to hear. Now this, the excerpts that I'm going to read, are from a book called The Yankee and Cowboy War by Carl Oglesby, published in softcover by Berkeley Medallion Books. In turn, this is taken from Volume 5 of the 26 volumes of Warren Commission Testimony and Exhibits. The excerpts that you're going to hear appear between pages 181 and 212. Again, Gerald Ford and Leon Jaworski and Arlen Specter heard what you're about to hear in addition to Earl Warren. Ruby: is there any way to get me to Washington? Warren: I beg your pardon? Ruby: is there any way of you getting me to Washington? Warren: I don't know of any. I'll be glad to talk to your counsel about what the situation is, Mr. Ruby, when we get an opportunity to talk. By the way, Ruby was intermittently begging for a chance to speak with Warren alone. Ruby: I don't think I will get a fair representation with my counsel, Joe Tannehill. I don't think so. I would like to request that I go to Washington and you take all the tests that I have to take. It's very important. Ruby's counsel, Joe Tannehill: Jack, will you tell him why you don't think you will get a fair representation? Ruby: because I've been over this for the longest time to get the lie detector test. Someone has been holding it back from me. I should interject, Ruby not only wanted lie detector tests, but sodium pentothal, and he wanted, quite obviously, to spill the beans and to have the veracity of what he was talking about tested. Skipping down and later. Ruby: gentlemen, unless you get me to Washington, you can't get a fair shake out of me. If you understand my way of talking, you've got to bring me to Washington to get the tests. Do I sound dramatic? Off the beam? Warren: no, you're speaking very, very rationally, and I'm really surprised that you can remember as much as you've remembered up to the present time. You have given it to us in great detail. Ruby: unless you can get me to Washington, and I'm not a crackpot, I have all my senses, I don't want to evade any crime I'm guilty of. But, Mr. Moore, have I spoken this way when we've talked? That's a reference to Elmer Moore, a Secret Service agent. Ruby, or Moore, yes, Ruby: unless you get me to Washington immediately, I'm afraid after what Mr. Tannehill has written there, well, it's too bad, Chief Warren, that you didn't get me to your headquarters 6 months ago. And still later, Ruby: are you staying overnight here, Chief Warren? Warren: no, I have to be back because we have an early session of court tomorrow morning. Ruby: is there any way of getting the polygraph here? Joe Decker, that's Dallas County Sheriff J.E. Bill Decker: may I make a suggestion? Jack, listen, you and I have had a lot of dealings. Do you want my officers removed from the room while you talk to this commission? Ruby: that wouldn't prove any truth. I wish the president were here right now. It's a terrible ordeal, I tell you that. And after unsuccessfully attempting to have Sheriff Decker clear the room of everyone, including his attorney, Joe Tannehill, he goes on, Ruby: gentlemen, if you want to hear any further testimony, you will have to get me to Washington soon, because it has something to do with you, Chief Warren. Do I sound sober enough to tell you this, Warren? Yes, go right ahead. Ruby: I want to tell the truth, and I can't tell it here. I can't tell it here. Does that make sense to you? Warren: well, let's not talk about sense, but I really can't see why you can't tell this commission. Ruby: but this isn't the place for me to tell what I want to tell. Chief Warren, your life is in danger in this city. Do you know that? Warren: no, I don't know that. If that is the thing that you don't want to talk about, you can tell me if you wish when this is all over, just between you and me. Ruby: no, I would like to talk to you in private. Warren: you may do that when you finish your story. You may tell me that phase of it. And still later, Ruby: I bet you haven't had a witness like me in your whole investigation. Is that correct? Warren: there are many witnesses whose memory has not been as good as yours, I tell you that honestly. Ruby: my reluctance to talk. You haven't had any witness in telling the story and finding so many problems. Warren: you have a greater problem than any witness we've had. Ruby: I have a lot of reasons for having those problems, Warren. I know that. And we want to respect your rights, whatever they may be. And I only want to hear what you are willing to tell us because I realize that you still have a great problem before you, and I'm not trying to press you. Ruby, when are you going back to Washington? Warren, I'm going back very shortly after we finish this hearing. I'm going to have some lunch. Ruby, can I make a statement? Warren, yes. Ruby, if you request me to go back to Washington with you right now, that couldn't be done, could it, Warren? No, it could not be done. It could not be done. There are a good many things involved in that, Mr. Ruby. Ruby, what are they, Warren? Well, the public attention that it would attract and the people who would be around. We have no place for you to be safe when we take you out. And we're not law enforcement officers, and it isn't our responsibility to go into anything of that kind. And certainly, it couldn't be done on a moment's notice this way. Ruby, gentlemen, my life is in danger here. Not with my guilty plea of execution, i.e. not because of killing Oswald. Do I sound sober enough to you as I say this, Warren? You do. You sound entirely sober. Ruby, from the moment I started my testimony, have I sounded as though, with the exception of becoming emotional, haven't I sounded as though I made sense what I was speaking about, Warren? You have indeed. I understand everything you have said. If I haven't, it's my fault. And Carl Oglesby then goes on to comment on Warren's response in the passage that I'm about to read to you. Oglesby says, a prized specimen of Warren integrity. If telling us the truth in Dallas would hurt you, cost you your life, we'd rather you just left it unsaid than go to the trouble of getting you to a place where you could feel safe to say it. And then Ruby goes on to say, Ruby, then I follow this up. I may not live tomorrow to give any further testimony. The reason why I add this to this, since you assure me that I have been speaking sense by then, I might be speaking sense by following what I've said, and the only thing I want to get out to the public, and I can't say it here, is with authenticity, with sincerity of the truth of everything and why my act was committed, but it can't be said here. It can be said, it's got to be said amongst people of the highest authority that would give me the benefit of the doubt. And following that, immediately give me the lie detector test after I do make the statement. Chairman Warren, if you felt that your life was in danger at the moment, how would you feel? Wouldn't you be reluctant to go on speaking, even though you request me to do so? Warren, I think I might have some reluctance if I was in your position. Yes, I think I would. I think I would figure it out very carefully as to whether it would endanger me or not. If you think that anything that I am doing or anything that I am asking you is endangering you in any way, shape, or form, I want you to feel absolutely free to say that the interview is over. Ruby, what happens then? I didn't accomplish anything. Warren, no, nothing's been accomplished. Ruby, well, then you won't follow up with anything further? Warren, there wouldn't be anything to follow up if you hadn't completed your statement. Ruby, you said you have the power to do what you want to do. Is that correct? Warren, exactly. Ruby, without any limitations? Warren, within the purview of the executive order which established the commission. Ruby, but you don't have the right to take a prisoner back with you when you want to? Warren, no. We have the power to subpoena witnesses to Washington if we want to do it, but we've taken the testimony of 200 or 300 people, I would imagine, here in Dallas, without going to Washington. Ruby, yes, but those people aren't Jack Ruby. Warren, no, they weren't. Ruby, they weren't. Warren, now, I want you to feel that we are not here to take any advantage of you because I know that you are in a delicate position, and unless you had indicated not only through your lawyers but also through your sister, who wrote a letter addressed either to me or to Mr. Rankin saying that you wanted to testify before the commission, unless she had told us that, I wouldn't have bothered you. Ruby, the thing is, that with your power that you have, Chief Justice Warren, and all these gentlemen, too much time has gone by for me to give you any benefit of what I may say now. Warren, Mr. Ruby, I think you are entitled to a statement to this effect, because you have been frank with us and you have told us your story. I think I can say to you that there has been no witness before this commission out of the hundreds we have questioned who have claimed to have any personal knowledge that you were a party to any conspiracy to kill our president. Ruby, yes, but you don't know this area here. And they squabble about the point, and as Oglesby notes, Warren really wants to evade this. Warren, well, I will make this additional statement to you, that if any witness should testify before the commission that you were, to their knowledge, a party to any conspiracy to assassinate the president, I assure you that we will give you the opportunity to deny it and to take any tests that you may desire to so disprove it. And still later, Ruby. And I wish that our beloved President Lyndon Johnson would have delved deeper into the situation, hear me, not to accept just circumstantial facts about my guilt or innocence, and would have questioned to find out the truth about me before he relinquished certain powers to these certain people. Who these certain people are, by the way, we'll see later. Consequently, a whole new form of government is going to take over our country, and I know I won't live to see you another time. Warren, or Ruby, do I sound sort of screwy in telling you these things? Warren, no. I think that's what you believe, or you wouldn't tell it under oath. Ruby, but it's a very serious situation. I guess it's too late to stop it, isn't it? And then Gerald Ford asks of Ruby Ford, are there any questions that ought to be asked to help clarify the situation that you described? Ruby, there is only one thing. If you don't take me back to Washington tonight to give me a chance to prove to the president that I'm not guilty, then you will see the most tragic, thing that will ever happen. And later, Ruby. Now, maybe something can be saved. It may not be too late, whatever happens, if our President Lyndon Johnson knew the truth from me. But if I am eliminated, there won't be any way of knowing. Right now, when I leave your presence now, I am the only one that can bring out the truth to our president who believes in righteousness and justice. But he's been told, I'm certain, that I was part of a plot to assassinate the president. I know, your hands are tied, you're helpless. Warren. Mr. Ruby, I think I can say this to you, that if he has been told any such thing, there is no indication of any kind that he believes it. Ruby. I'm sorry, Chief Justice Warren. I thought I'd be very effective in telling you what I've said here. But in all fairness to everyone, maybe all I want to do is to beg that if they found out I was telling the truth, maybe they can succeed in what their motives are, but maybe my people won't be tortured and mutilated. That is, Ruby begs forgiveness from the assassination conspiracy, having failed in his effort to rat on it through double meanings tossed into Warren's ear. That's Oglesby's interjection. And continuing, Warren. Well, you may be sure that my president and his whole commission will do anything that is necessary to see that your people are not tortured. Ruby, no. Warren, you may be sure of that. Ruby, no. The only way you can do it is if he knows the truth, that I'm telling the truth, and why I was down in that basement Sunday morning, and maybe some sense of decency will come out, and they can still fulfill their plan, as I stated before, without my people going through torture and mutilation. Warren. The president will know everything that you have said. Everything that you've said. Ruby. But I won't be around, Chief Justice. I won't be around to verify those things that you're going to tell the president. Joe Tannehill, who never left the room. Who do you think is going to eliminate you, Jack? Ruby. I have been used for a purpose. And there will be a certain tragic occurrence happening if you don't take my testimony and somehow vindicate me so my people won't suffer because of what I've done. Warren. But we have taken your testimony. We have it here. It will be in permanent form for the President of the United States and for the Congress of the United States and for the courts of the United States and for the people of the entire world. It's there. It will be recorded for all to see. That is the purpose of our coming here today. We feel that you are entitled to have your story told. Ruby. You've lost me, though. You have lost me, Chief Justice Warren. Warren, lost you? In what sense? Ruby, I won't be around for you to come and question again. Warren, well, it's very hard for me to believe that. I'm sure that everybody would want to protect you to the very limit. Ruby, all I want is a lie detector test, and you refuse to give it to me. Because as it stands now in the truth serum and any other pentothal, how do you pronounce it, whatever it is, and they will not give it to me because I want to tell the truth. And then I want to leave this world. How are we going to communicate and so on, Warren? We will communicate directly with you. Ruby, you have a lost cause, Earl Warren. You don't stand a chance. They feel about you like they do about me, Chief Justice Warren. I shouldn't hurt your feelings in telling you that. By the way, Earl Warren was a bete noir to the far right, the John Birch Society in particular. Recall that the day before Kennedy was killed, Ruby stopped by the offices of Lamar Hunt of the powerful reactionary Hunt family in Texas. Lamar Hunt passed away about the same time as Gerald Ford. Again, Ruby's syntax is quite tortured here and quite strained, but it's pretty obvious that he is trying to tell the Warren Commission that he was part of a conspiracy to kill President Kennedy. In fact, he pretty much came out and said that, although not in the most grammatical fashion. And basically, he wanted to be taken to Washington to be given a lie detector test and to communicate this information in other circumstances than the one that he was in. Eventually, Ruby came down with cancer and died of a fast-acting case of cancer. In his last letter, smuggled out from the Dallas jail, Jack Ruby indicated the nature of the elements that were in control of the United States. Now, again, his grammar isn't the best. We're going to conclude with an excerpt from the book, The Man Who Knew Too Much, about the assassination of President Kennedy. It's authored by Dick Russell and published in hardcover by Carolyn Graff. In his last letter from prison, Jack Ruby clarifies what he was trying to tell Earl Warren, Gerald Ford, Leon Jaworski, and Arlen Specter. Don't believe the Warren report. That was only put out to make me look innocent. I'm going to die a horrible death anyway, so what would I have to gain by writing all this? So you must believe me. There was only one kind of people that would do such a thing, meaning the assassination of President Kennedy. That would have to be the Nazis. And that is who is in power in this country right now. Japan is also in on the deal, but the old warlords are going to come back. South America is also full of these Nazis. If those people were so determined to frame me, then you must be convinced that they had an ulterior motive for doing same. There is only one kind of people that would go to such extremes, and that would be the master race. So again, Jack Ruby was aware of the United States being controlled by something akin to an underground Reich. Sound familiar, listeners? Well, that again, that was Jack Ruby talking to Gerald Ford as well as Earl Warren and Leon Jaworski and Gerald Ford. Of course, Leon Jaworski, associated with the CIA, went on to become Watergate special prosecutor. Gerald Ford pardoned Richard Nixon of all crimes committed. And that is his legacy. Again, he's supposed to be he was hailed as a Norman Rockwell painting come to life. He was more like a George Lincoln Rockwell painting come to life. And as I said inside one, anybody who thinks Gerald Ford helped to end our national nightmare is dreaming. When that front-running SOB died, it was the only good goddamn thing he ever did, and he was 93 years late on that. That concludes For the Record program number 579, side 2. This has been the title of the broadcast is Give Me a Break, Reflections on the Death of Gerald Ford. This has been recorded on January 7th of 2007. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.